Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams, whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
You're listening to Leaf Filter Radio, and the guru of gutter protection himself, Chris Counihan, is here to take your most pressing leaf-related questions.
Hey, everybody, Chris here. I understand we have Ron on the line. Ron, where are you calling from?
Uh-oh. Ron, are you calling from a ladder?
Well, I was. I wanted to ask Chris what I need to do to get my gutters ready to have leaf filter installed.
Oh, Ron, you don't have to do anything. A leaf filter trusted pro will come out and clean out your gutters, realign and seal your gutters, and install leaf filter, America's number one gutter protection system.
So I didn't need to get on this ladder?
Ron, leaf filter trusted pros are in your neighborhood and ready to help. Just visit leaffilter.com/day to schedule your free gutter inspection and get up to 30% off.
Thank goodness. What was that site?
That's leaffilter.com/day for your free gutter inspection today. See representative for warranty details. Promotion is 20% off plus a 10% senior or military discount. One discount per household.
Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. This week, Damon Dash and the court-blocked Jay-Z NFT. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we are going to be taking a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when UK music industry news was dominated by talk of when exactly the results of the Events Research Programme would be published.
Yeah, the Events Research Programme being the previously discussed initiative launched by the UK government earlier this year, where we've had a whole load of test events over the weeks and months with ever-increasing capacities. The aim of the programme was to identify how the live sector could get full capacity shows back up and running safely in the context of COVID as COVID restrictions slowly lift around the UK over 2021. That was the aim of the Events Research Programme. Initially welcomed by the live entertainment sector, the culture sector, the sports sector, various promoters and sports organizations participated. But in more recent weeks, increased frustration in the music and cultural sectors that, despite getting some indication, mainly by ministers giving interviews in the press, that this project had been a success, and they found out that by just having a few extra logistical measures in force at, you know, high capacity events, you could pretty much completely reduce there being any higher risk of COVID transmissions at those events. And so the live sector was getting excited that would mean two things. First of all, that information could all be shared with the industry. So as people get prepared for bigger shows to return in July and August and September, the live sector, the promoters, the theatres could start putting these extra logistical measures in place to ensure that when they reopen, they can do so as safely as possible. So everyone was excited about getting that information. And also the hope was that because of this research and because we would know how to do full capacity shows safely, those full capacity shows would be able to return as originally planned on the 21st of June. But of course, that didn't happen. The UK government announced that its original plan to get full capacity shows back on the 21st of June, that was now not happening. We're now looking at something more like the 19th of July. But alongside that announcement, no official publication of the findings of the Events Research Programme. Instead, it was announced that this programme was going to extend and more events were going to become part of it. And over the last week, you've increasingly sensed from a lot of people in the live industry that they're becoming suspicious of two things. Firstly, the reason why we're not seeing the results of the Events Research Programme being published is because those results contradict the current government policy that full capacity shows can't return. And secondly, they were extending the programme so they could cherry pick certain sporting events, a couple of entertainment events, and allow them to go ahead as part of the programme to sort of placate voters while keeping the rest of the theatre and live music industry in shutdown. So yes, throughout the week it's been, prove us wrong, prove that conspiracy is wrong, just give us the frickin' data from this programme. And then the government said, oh, we are going to publish it very soon. And then they said, we're going to publish it shortly. As we record this, we hear actually imminent is now the word we could be using.
Yes, as you say, the words used by government have changed over the course of the week. They haven't ever not been vague, but they have changed over the course of the week. Partly that's come down to the fact that there was a legal challenge by the live music trade body Live and a whole group of theatre companies, including Andrew Lloyd Webber's really useful group. We discussed a couple of weeks ago that Andrew Lloyd Webber had said there would be the mother of all legal challenges if the government didn't allow theatres and other live businesses to reopen on the 21st of June. Initially, it looked like he was backing down from that, but then he did join this legal action, basically saying that the government had done all this research. It appeared that it had found that actually the live industry could completely reopen without much danger of transmission of COVID-19, so long as certain rules were stuck to, but then extended lockdown for everyone, including the live industry. And I mean, in the run-up to when it looked like the 21st of June was going to slip, people in the live business were all saying, look, as far as we can see from what we've been told about these researchers, it shows that we can open up safely. So let us do that and let us see the results of the research so that we know exactly what we need to do in order to open up safely. There were various other things that went along with this. A lot of the live industry was saying, look, we welcomed this program when you announced it. We did all these pilot events at our own costs, at a loss, in order to work out how we were going to be able to open up safely. And then you've just sat on the results. And even for events like music festivals that will be happening after the 19th of July, we've seen more cancellations over the last week because without the publication of these results, they don't know what the recommendations are in order to be safe. So they can't plan an event where at the last minute you might have to change how you do things. I mean, it could be that you aren't allowed to sell alcohol and suddenly having to shut down all your bars at the last minute, which are obviously a big part of your income at a festival. That's going to be a problem for you. So we're still stuck with this issue of it being impossible to really plan a major live event. And again, as has come up over the course of this week, there is no insurance available for live events against cancellation because it's not available on the commercial market. And unlike some governments around the world, the British government has not put in place state-backed insurance to make up for that gap. So in planning to put on a major live event, you are at quite a major risk of major losses. And obviously we've seen any event that was planning to take place between the 21st of June and the 19th of July has been hit by that and did suddenly have to cancel all their plans. So there have been numerous and repeated calls across the course this week for the government to just publish this research. And as we're expecting, probably by the time we've finished recording this episode of Setlist, that report will be out. And so the live industry will be scrabbling to plan events that will take place from the end of July onwards, hopefully.
Yeah, so despite various government representatives, including ministers and spokespeople, being unhelpfully vague about when we could expect the findings of this research programme earlier this week, we think that as we're recording this podcast, they may finally publish some of the findings. As a result of that, we can't talk about them on this week's podcast because we're already recording and they're not out yet. And I mean, who knows? It might turn out that what they publish is a load of nonsense. So as a result of that, we're not actually talking about this week.
No, but we are going to talk about things. Don't you worry. Later on, we'll be discussing the private Universal Music share deal that edges it closer to a public stock market listing. But first, a judge in New York has issued a temporary restraining order barring Damon Dash from selling an NFT that some believe attempts to assign the rights to Jay-Z's debut album Reasonable Doubt to whoever buys that NFT. The injunction follows a complaint from the record label that Damon Dash co-founded with Jay-Z himself and Kareem Burke, in which Damon Dash still owns a stake, that's Rockefeller Records, which released and still controls the recording rights in Reasonable Doubt. The legal filing from Rockefeller Records alleges that Damon Dash had tried to sell an NFT that would assign the rights in Reasonable Doubt to the buyer. But despite being a shareholder in Rockefeller, Damon Dash doesn't actually directly own or control any of the rights in Reasonable Doubt. And He's therefore in no position to sell those rights as an NFT or otherwise. So when Dash originally put up this NFT auction, it got cancelled, but reps for the label said that they suspected he was planning another sale. So in their lawsuit, they said, Dash can't sell what he doesn't own. By attempting such a sale, Dash has converted a corporate asset and has breached his fiduciary duties. The court should stop Dash and hold him accountable for his brazen theft.
So on one level, this is an interesting lawsuit because it's the latest bust up between former business partners Jay-Z and Damon Dash, who used to run the Rockefeller Records label together back in the day and are still both shareholders in the label. I mean, the label is not a frontline label anymore. It doesn't sign artists or release records, but it's still sitting on catalogue. Always fun when Damon Dash and Jay-Z have a little bit of a run-in, but also interesting because one of the first music industry lawsuits to be filed in relation to these non-fungible tokens, which we've name-checked a few times in the CMU Daily in recent months because they've become quite a hyped thing in the music industry. Have we actually mentioned them on Setlist at any point?
I don't know. I don't know if we actually have spoken about them on here. If we have, we almost certainly said they were stupid and pointless.
Andy is quite disparaging about all things non-fungible tokens.
It's because they're all stupid and pointless.
So, these things, NFTs, basically a non-fungible token is just a little bit of data, in essence, a statement of fact, if you like, stored on a blockchain, usually the Ethereum blockchain, but other blockchains are available. And when you sell an NFT, well, interesting question is, what are you actually selling? Now, NFTs have been used in different sectors, in the visual arts sector, for example. And I mean, NFTs have been around for a while, but they've become super hyped this year, really. And particularly in the music industry, it's only in recent months that we started to see artists selling music NFTs. But whenever an artist does that, interesting question is, well, what are they selling? Because quite often a music NFT is linked to a bit of digital content. Now, there might be a track, it might be a video, it may be a combination of the two. Some NFTs have also been connected to a physical asset, like a box set or a ticket or a meet and greet or something like that. But a lot of them are linked to a bit of digital content. And so you might say, okay, well, if this thing called an NFT is being auctioned off and it's linked to a piece of digital content and it's going up on a website and people seem to be paying thousands of pounds, maybe even tens of thousands of pounds, in some cases, hundreds of thousands of pounds, in some cases, millions of pounds, or usually dollars, or actually, I mean, obviously, because they're on the blockchain, you actually bid in cryptocurrencies, don't you? So there would be some weird cryptocurrency amount. But anyway, some people have been bidding an awful lot of money on NFTs, including music NFTs. And so you might be forgiven for thinking that if people are spending a lot of money to buy a music NFT linked to a track or a video, then at the very least, what the person is buying is the intellectual property rights in that piece of content, which obviously, if it was music, there would be both recording rights and there would be accompanying song rights or publishing rights. If there was a video, there would also be the copyright in the actual visual element in the video itself. And surely you might think, if I'm paying 50 grand for an NFT, I am getting the actual copyrights in the content that it's linked to. But key thing about NFTs, what you're actually buying depends on the terms of the token. It depends on what data is being put into the blockchain. And the data put into the blockchain could say that this person, by buying the token, now owns the copyright in this recording, this song, this video. That could be part of the token. But it could equally say that the buyer doesn't get any stake in the copyright, but maybe they get a revenue share, a royalty share, or maybe they're just getting a kind of license that allows them to access and possibly share in a non-commercial way the content that is linked to the token. Although actually, if you look at quite a lot of the music NFTs that have been sold, in some ways, they're not even offering that. In that, the bit of content linked to the NFT is just an MP3 or an MPEG. Now, obviously, Once an MP3 is on the internet, or an MPEG is on the internet, if there's one thing the last 20 years of the music industry has taught us, is that once an MP3 is on the internet, there will be millions of copies of the MP3 on the internet. So it may be that you're buying an NFT linked to an MP3, but it doesn't mean you're getting unique access to that bit of music, because almost certainly that music's going to be all over the internet. Indeed, Kings of Leon were one of the hyped acts, weren't they? Because they were, as far as the music industry is concerned, one of the first artists to do a big NFT launch, or an NFT drop, as they say. And that was around their new album, I think.
Yeah, it was. They did various things around their latest album, When You See Yourself, including, as well as doing stuff like with the album itself, but kind of selling backstage passes and meet and greet stuff. They did all sorts of things, all of them pointless.
And crucially, the point at which the NFT went on sale, the album arrived on Spotify. So it wasn't like in terms of the actual music. Yeah, there were some tickets and some extra goodies that people were getting. But in terms of the actual music, not only were they not getting rights in the music, not only were they not getting any sort of royalty or revenue share associated with the music, they weren't even getting privileged access to the music, because the music was on all the streaming services. And it seems to me, actually, quite a lot of the music NFTs that have been sold, in essence, what you are buying is kind of bragging rights. That if you're a super fan, you, rather than just listening to the music on a streaming service or downloading the MP3 or the, you know, the digital file through iTunes or whatever, or just, you know, buying a box set on Amazon, you're buying it in a way that there's kind of a certificate from the artist that says you're buying the real thing because you're a special super fan. And not only are we going to make a certificate that says that, we're going to put the certificate in the blockchain. So now the world will know forever that you got the real deal.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like, it's similar to if the band wrote on a piece of paper, oh, you own this album, and gave that to you, except it's really bad for the environment. So it's a bit like, rather than the band handing you one bit of paper, just handing you a load of trees they've cut down and then set on fire. And then they take the note and they put it in a cupboard somewhere, and the building, the cupboard's in, collapses, and the town is entirely deserted and everyone forgets it's there. But you still think it's probably there if you really think hard about it. So that's what you're buying for your money.
The warm glow inside of knowing that you're a better person because you got all of that endorsed by the artist, recorded in the blockchain. I did a talk about NFTs and the use of NFTs in music space a few weeks ago, which actually I think they recorded. It may even be, I think it is actually available on Spotify.
Did they put it on the blockchain?
It's not on the blockchain, on Spotify, because they wanted people to actually be able to access it. And the example I gave is, if you currently go onto Amazon and buy the Queen Platinum Collection, so that's all three of Queen's greatest hits in a metal box, which was released at some point 10 years ago or so, maybe longer ago. I don't know. Anyway, it's still available on Amazon, and it will cost you something like £16 to buy new. Or you could go to eBay, where somebody is selling a signed version of the box set, only signed by Brian May and Roger Taylor, because it's a relatively recent release. So it's not signed by
Freddie. It would be concerning.
It's not signed by Freddie.
If Freddie Mercury had signed it.
Because it's not that old. And so you can buy it signed for something like £700. So what is it about the signed version with some scrawl on it that is worth so much more money than buying it new without the autographs? But then, of course, if you buy that £700 signed version, question, how do you know those autographs are genuine? Well, the seller on eBay that I found, who's selling the signed version of the album, has a certificate from the International Association of Autograph Collectors, which apparently exists.
Right.
And the certificate confirms it's the real deal. The NFT is basically the certificate. That's what you're getting when you buy an NFT. And in many cases, as I say, what you're actually buying is bragging rights. And it's interesting, having spoken to a bunch of lawyers about this, all of whom, any lawyer that sort of works in the digital intellectual property space, has been getting calls in recent months from the music industry and from big brands about NFTs. Although one of them did tell me, it's mainly marketing departments who are phoning up about this. So clearly, music companies and brands are seeing it as a marketing thing rather than an actual new part of their business. But lots of lawyers have been asked about how you go about minting and dropping an NFT, the terms that they tend to use. And quite a few of those lawyers were saying, you need to be incredibly clear when you put an NFT on sale. Or if you're a buyer, you need to be incredibly clear before you hand over a chunk of money what it is that you're getting. Because you might be getting some rights, you might be getting some revenue share, but there's a very high chance that all you're getting is some bragging rights. And maybe that's all you want. And if you think that it's worth paying $5,000 for some bragging rights, well, so be it. And if artists can get money out of superfans or stupid speculators on the blockchain for doing that, then I guess that's all brilliant. But some lawyers I did speak to were saying they can foresee that there could be some disputes and some litigation, or at the very least, some bad PR for certain people in the music industry in the months ahead, when people start to realize that the NFT they bought isn't quite what they thought it was and isn't quite what was implied in the blurb that accompanied the sale on whatever auction site was used. And whether or not that's a fan who thinks that they're acquiring some rights and they're not, or it's someone who's speculating on NFTs who thought they were acquiring rights that would be worth something down the line that they could resell, and it turns out that all they were buying were some worthless bragging rights, maybe we'll get some litigation around the confusion regarding what it is that you're buying with an NFT. And in some ways, that's relevant to this case involving Damon Dash and Jay-Z, because the two sides are disputing what exactly was up for sale with the NFT that Damon Dash put up for auction.
Yes, because as we said, the Rockefeller side are saying he's trying to sell his rights in Jay-Z's first album. He's not allowed to do that. And that's why we've had the original auction taken down. We've now got an injunction from a court in New York saying he's not allowed to put this NFT up for sale, at least in the short term. But Damon Dash says that that's not what he's selling at all. He says he's selling his share in the label rather than any actual intellectual property rights, and would just allow the buyer to receive his cut of the money that's generated by the label's catalogue. But that buyer wouldn't have any direct control over the label's copyrights. So he was quoted as saying to the gossip site TMZ, under the terms of the deal with a potential buyer, the buyer would buy my share of Rockefeller Records and Jay-Z will have exclusive administration rights. So, I mean, that's not actually very clear. Also, I mean, I suppose that this highlights the sort of buzziness of NFTs, because none of that seems like something that needs to be done with any involvement of blockchain. That sounds like a paper contract at best.
Yeah, there's nothing to stop Damon Dash, given how much interest there is at the moment in buying both rights and royalty and revenue shares in classic music catalogues. There are plenty of other ways that he could go and do that deal if that is the deal that he wants to do. But yeah, I mean, in the lawsuit that was filed, the other Rockefeller shareholders included blurbs from the NFT auction site where this NFT was for a while put up for sale. And it seems to be suggesting that the buyer was going to get at least some of the copyright in the Reasonable Doubt album. But Damon Dash, yeah, not yet through the courts, through the much more credible forum of TMZ, has said, everyone's got this wrong. I was just selling my share of the label. I'm totally allowed to do that. I just chose to do it for some weird reason as an NFT. But he is yet to formally respond to the lawsuit from his fellow shareholders. He's got to the 1st of July to do that. Otherwise, this injunction might be made permanent. So it remains to be seen what he actually says, assuming that he puts in a court filing in the next few days. But until he does so, he is
Restrained and enjoined from altering in any way, selling, assigning, pledging, encumbering, contracting with regard to, or in any way deposing of any property interest in Reasonable Doubt, including its copyright, and including through any means, such as auctioning a non-fungible token, NFT, reflecting such interests.
So that is what a New York court said last week. So we await to see how he responds through more formal channels than TMZ and try to get to the bottom of what the hell was he trying to sell through this NFT? What was it that somebody would have bought? And once all of that's cleared up, A, can Damon Dash go ahead with this sale? And B, I mean, let's say it takes a few months for that all to be sorted out. Will people still be doing stuff like this through NFTs in a few months? Or will all of the hype have gone by then? The NFT bubble will have burst and everyone will just go back to, you know, writing contracts and exchanging emails and doing it the good old-fashioned way. We will see, I guess.
You're listening to Leaf Filter Radio, and the guru of gutter protection himself, Chris Counihan, is here to take your most pressing leaf-related questions.
Hey, everybody, Chris here. I understand we have Ron on the line. Ron, where are you calling from?
Uh-oh. Ron, are you calling from a ladder?
Well, I was. I wanted to ask Chris what I need to do to get my gutters ready to have leaf filter installed.
Oh, Ron, you don't have to do anything. A Leaf Filter Trusted Pro will come out and clean out your gutters, realign and seal your gutters, and install Leaf Filter, America's number one gutter protection system.
So I didn't need to get on this ladder?
Ron, Leaf Filter Trusted Pros are in your neighborhood and ready to help. Just visit leaffilter.com/day to schedule your free gutter inspection and get up to 30% off.
Thank goodness. What was that site?
That's leaffilter.com/day for your free gutter inspection today. See representative for warranty details. Promotion is 20% off plus a 10% senior or military discount. One discount per household.
And finally this week, Universal Music Group owner Vivendi has agreed to sell another 10% of the major label to a US-based investment company, Pershing Square Tontine Holdings Limited, ahead of the planned listing of the music company on the Dutch Stock Exchange later this year. That deal is worth about $4 billion, which means that ahead of that stock market listing, Universal is valued at about $40 billion.
So yes, this is the latest development in the very long-running offloading of the Universal Music Group by its current owner, Vivendi. So as soon as it became clear that the record industry was back in growth and that the streaming boom was going to continue for the foreseeable future and that music rights were becoming prized assets again amongst the investment community, this is a few years ago now, Vivendi indicated that it was going to sell off some, or possibly all, initially they kind of said some, of Universal Music, the biggest music rights company in the world. And first of all, they said, maybe we'll do an IPO on a stock exchange. Then they were like, no, we're not going to do an IPO. We're going to do some strategic deals and sell off maybe as much as 50% of the shares in Universal. Then they announced that they were talking to a consortium of investors led by the Chinese web giant Tencent. That consortium then, right at the end of 2019, bought 10% of the Universal Music Group, leaving Vivendi with 90%. But they had an option to buy another 10%, which they then took up. So it means that the Tencent consortium currently controls 20%. Then in the middle of all of that, Vivendi said, okay, actually, we've decided we're going to completely spin Universal Music off as a standalone business, and we're going to list it on the Euronext Stock Exchange in the Netherlands. And then they made a little bit of a thing about how Universal Music has a heritage in the Netherlands, which if you follow the sort of the journey of all the major labels back through time, what is now the Universal Music Group was kind of created back in the 90s when they merged the old MCA music company with Polygram, which was a Dutch company that created the Universal Music Group. So there is sort of a link back to the Netherlands. So they're going to list the Universal Music Group on the stock exchange in Amsterdam. And basically what they said initially was, once we list, as we list on the stock exchange, we're going to distribute 60% of the shares in this new standalone Universal Music company. We're going to hand out those shares to Vivendi's current shareholders, you know, pro rata. So if you've got, I can't do the maths. I was going to do the maths then. If you've got 5% of shares in Vivendi, I guess you'd be getting what, 3% of the shares in Universal? That's right, isn't it? Is that maths right?
Sure.
I think that maths is right. So the original plan was 60% of the shares in this newly independent Universal Music Group would go to Vivendi shareholders. The Tencent consortium would still have their 20%, and then Vivendi would hold on to the other 20% and keep that, even once Universal was a standalone business. Then earlier this year, they said, you know what? We think we can cash in even bigger here with all the hype around music rights at the moment. we think we're going to sell another 10% before the stock market listing, so we can get all of that money, which means that once Universal Music Group is a company direct listed on the Dutch Stock Exchange, the Vivendi itself will only have 10% of that business. Then there was rumors about, well, who will be buying this 10%? We knew it was going to be an American because they said that weirdly in their statement. And then I think earlier this month, we found out that it was this rather grand sounding Pershing Square Tontine. Is that how you said it? Or did you go with Tontine?
I think I said Tontine, but it could be Tontine.
Tontine, Tontine. People listening, you can just choose for yourself. Which would you prefer? Because it has to be said that Pershing Square Tontine Tontine Holdings Limited, as a company, currently does nothing. It's a nothing yes. company.
There's a reason you have not heard of it before, unless you've been following this story.
It's what is known as a special purpose acquisition company, or a SPAC, or a blank check company. So this is an investment term. So basically, what a SPAC usually involves is that an investment entity, firm, fund, goes to a stock exchange, like the New York Stock Exchange, raise a load of money on the stock market with the intent of then using that money to buy another company, usually outright, and then it's kind of a sneaky backwards way of making that other company a publicly listed company. So rather than that company having an IPO, in essence, you do the IPO first and then you buy the private company and it becomes a publicly listed company. That's what usually happens with these blank check companies, these SPACs. Although with this SPAC, that's not what's happening, because they're not buying a company outright and then backwards engineering it to become listed on the New York Stock Exchange. They are basically using a chunk, not all, but a chunk of the money they raised, I think earlier this year, maybe last year when they raised that money in the US, they're using that to buy up this 10% of the Universal Music. And I think they're just going to, you know, in the same way that Vivendi is distributing 60% of the shares to its shareholders, this SPAC is going to distribute its 10% to its shareholders. So it's all very complicated and confusing. But one of the developments on this story in the last week is that we knew that deal was being negotiated. That deal has now been finalized. It is still subject to a couple of regulatory staff and the shareholders greenlighting it, I think. So it's not 100% in the bag, but basically the terms have been agreed between this investment fund and Vivendi, so it is looking very likely that once Universal Music becomes a standalone company, the shareholders in this special purpose acquisition company will be controlling between them 10% of that business.
So after that deal was confirmed, the Vivendi shareholders all got together, or probably virtually, but it was Vivendi's annual general shareholder meeting, and at that, those shareholders approved the plan for spinning off Universal Music into its own standalone publicly listed company. Following that meeting, the company confirmed that shareholders overwhelmingly approved the distribution of 60% of Universal Music Group shares with a record level of 99.9% positive votes, demonstrating their full support for the recommended strategic approach and the options chosen by the management board to implement this transaction. I mean, they say full support, but what about that 0.1%? That's someone in there not happy about it. That's not full support. It's almost full. I want 100% or nothing.
You wanted to
cancel the whole thing.
A fudge in the statement to acknowledge the 0.1% of dissent.
Yes, but despite my insistence that they now cancel this whole plan, apparently they're not going to. And so the new Universal Music Group company will be listed on the Euronext Stock Exchange in Amsterdam, possibly on the 21st of September this year. That's the date they are aiming for.
So that's something for everybody. Everybody who's a fan of music companies listing on stock exchanges. Maybe we could buy a share.
I mean, that's a good date. You've got time to plan your street party. So that's good that they've given a good amount of notice.
And surely COVID rules will be allowing, you know, I mean, it depends what the events research program research says.
Well, come on. I mean, even if we're back in lockdown, then they're going to lift it so we can have a universal street party. I don't think there's any question about that.
Boris Johnson will make it part of the event research program. Not that he has jurisdiction over Amsterdam, but I'm sure he'll try.
But this is, it's going to be a worldwide street party. Come on.
So maybe, I mean, let us know what you think. Setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Should we be selling our Spotify share? Our single Spotify share? I don't know what it's worth at the moment. I mean, obviously, Spotify share price was doing quite well relatively recently. Maybe we should sell our Spotify share and use the profits to buy a Universal Music share.
Almost certainly.
There you go. That's a bit of a cliffhanger ending for everyone to tune in next week to find out what we decide.
Well, yes, because that is all we've got time for on this edition of Setlist. Do remember to subscribe to the show to receive every new episode automatically to your podcast player and device of choice. You can also rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and probably other places too, but Apple Podcasts is the one that really counts, I think. That's where the algorithm is really king. Come on now, we all know that. If you've got any questions or comments about anything we've discussed on this week's show or any other show, or any show that's ever been on anywhere ever, I will discuss anything at all with you. Setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
A mochi moment from Sadie, who writes, I'm not crying, you're crying. This is what I said during my first appointment with my physician at Mochi, because I didn't have to convince him I needed a GLP-1. He understood, and I felt supported, not judged. I came for the weight loss and stayed for the empathy. Thanks, Sadie. I'm Myra Ahmed, founder of Mochi Health. To find your mochi moment, visit joinmochi.com.
Sadie is a Mochi member compensated for her story.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.